forcible starvation and infectious disease are famous dance partners, from colonial America's genocidal Western expansion to Darfur to democratic Kampuchea. Engineered starvation and infection have gone hand in hand. Now, Gaza, reduced to rubble, 1.5 million people displaced, half of them children, no safe place to rest their heads and eat a healthy meal, packed into crowded tent camps on the floors of UN refugee centers, a favorite target for Israeli airstrikes, or on the street. Ideal conditions for respiratory infection, diarrhea, and hepatitis, now rampant, along with rats and mosquitoes. To learn more about the gathering infectious disease crisis in Little Gaza, 9 months into Israel's genocidal war, the GPM spoke with the global spokesperson for the World Health Organization. Margaret Harris is a physician, an epidemiologist, and a former journalist. We reached her in Geneva. Hello, Margaret Harris. Thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Hello, David Kattenberg, and it's a pleasure to be with you and with your listeners.
How does the infectious disease situation in Gaza at the moment compare with the epidemiology of infectious diseases in other theaters of conflict historically, recent times?
That's a very interesting question. I think we've probably not seen a conflict where there's been so much destruction of infrastructure and so much herding of a population into the very area where the destruction of infrastructure is occurring. So you are creating all the conditions for the infectious diseases that thrive in a community that is very, very in very close proximity. But you're providing also things like the absence of clean water, the opportunity for all the parasites, all the vectors that carry infectious diseases, particularly the mosquitoes, but also the rats and the other insect life, to thrive. So they're thriving in the garbage, in the water that's lying on the ground, and you've got the people so crowded together. So as you know, a vector can only really do its job if it's got lots of people that it can spread whatever infectious disease it's carrying from person to person. So we're really creating the absolute, in that conflict, the perfect conditions for the spread of nearly all the infectious disease threats known to man have been created.
And of course, Gaza has been under comprehensive Israeli siege for 17 years. It's been denied access progressively to clean water. We've read so much about how 95% or 90% of Gaza's source of water, aquifers, is contaminated, it's polluted, it's been maintained on a strict caloric diet, which was publicly announced by Israeli advisor Dov Weisglass so succinctly back in 2006. We're going to maintain them on a diet just above the starvation level. And so even before October 7th, conditions were just awful.
Indeed. Interestingly, though, you talk about nutrition. We didn't really see significant malnutrition. We did see some threats to nutrition, for instance, imbalance in the intake of the best nutrient content. So we saw diets that were unbalanced, but we did not see what we would define as the kind of malnutrition or the severe acute malnutrition that we're now seeing widely among children in Gaza. So, yes, this conflict has occurred on the background of a continuing restriction of entry of many, many things, and certainly a society that was utterly dependent, was under a form of blockade and was dependent on many things coming inside. So once that was cut off, it meant that there was no alternative, or very little alternative. But even what alternatives existed, like the food that people were growing, the agricultural land's been destroyed. So the foods that people were growing are just not available. And in terms of sort of pollutants, contaminants, now there's massive, massive levels of chemical dust throughout the strip because there's been such destruction. The buildings and then the components of those buildings are now released as dust. So there's that's not an infectious disease, but that's a very much a threat to health. And again, because of that blockade, because of the cut off electricity, any existing water and sanitation infrastructure, anything that has not been damaged by the bombardment, is utterly dependent on fuel coming in from outside. So a lot of the time that's not functioning because there simply isn't fuel.
And the healthcare system has been all but demolished. Most of the hospitals in Gaza are completely eliminated.
That's correct.
All the determinants of the approaches to infection control that we see in modern developed societies have been eliminated. Hospitals, clinics, proper sanitation, healthy housing. 75% of the housing in Gaza has been destroyed. So it's an infection control nightmare.
Precisely. And again, it's even just for surveillance. We do have numbers. We know that we're getting on close to a million respiratory infections, particularly among children. We've got similar numbers on cases of acute diarrhea, but that's only what's being picked up at the primary health clinics, and most of those are closed. So the true numbers have got to be much greater. That's just a point.
A million respiratory infections. What are the agents of these infections? What are kids getting?
They haven't really been identified because they haven't been able to take the swabs. We started to see hepatitis. So again, it was syndromally identified. People had jaundice. So we'd call it acute jaundice. Now they managed to finally, after a couple of weeks, get a few swabs and get them out to Egypt and test it, because there was concern about whether it was hepatitis A, whether it was C. I'm pretty sure it was an infectious hepatitis rather than B or the others that are bloodborne. We were particularly concerned that it might be C because it's got a very high mortality rate among pregnant women. And we did get those swabs back and we did identify that it was hepatitis A, but that's only a few cases that we were able to test. You know, most of these things are just identified by the syndrome. Acute diarrhea, hepatitis. So what we're reporting is really we are seeing the people with symptoms and saying, the teams in the primary healthcare clinics are saying, this person came in with diarrhea and writing it down. But we're really not identifying the pathogens.
And like the diarrheal infections, what are the agents? Is bacterial? Is it viral?
Both, it's thought. It's probably most likely viral. Again, we're seeing the kind of diarrhea that passing very rapidly between children under five. The rates in some of the reporting were at least 25 times higher than they would normally see among children during that period of time. But they were not taking swabs. They were not testing as such. They were, again, they are reported syndromally. I mean, as you mentioned, many of the hospitals are not functioning. They're at the very best dressing stations or trauma stabilization stations rather than places that can do the full diagnosis, management, and full treatment of any condition. We don't have functioning laboratories because the main laboratory for Gaza, particularly for infectious diseases, was at Al-Shifa Hospital, and Al-Shifa Hospital's essentially been destroyed. All the services, all the advanced services that were there were destroyed.
How about cholera?
We're not seeing cholera so far, and we are looking out for it. We've not seen the pathogen, Vibrio cholerae, in Gaza for, I think it's something like 20 years, for a very long period of time. So we do not expect that it's in the population. However, there has been cholera in neighboring countries such as Lebanon. And, you know, people do come in and out still. So we are watching very closely for cholera, but we have not seen.
And that would be a disaster.
Indeed. But honestly, any kind of diarrhea in a child under five who's starving, who's already very malnourished, who's traumatized, who's exhausted, can also be a death sentence. Also in parents, pregnant women, these things, or people who are not getting enough to eat, if they then have diarrhea, they're not going to be absorbing what little nutrients they get. So even though, yes, cholera would be a disaster, but any diarrhea is a major threat to health and life.
Skin infections?
Yes, we're seeing thousands and thousands of skin infections, again, particularly among the children, but people have got scabies, they've got lice. Many of the children have chickenpox that's been spreading, and chickenpox is a viral infection, but its main manifestation is a very itchy rash, a very discomforting rash. We're also seeing people are just simply suffering from massive insect bites. And many of the children have impetigo, which, as you know, is an overgrowth from their own skin pathogens. And again, even though impetigo normally resolves in a child, but it normally resolves if you can at least provide, wash them regularly and provide them with antibiotic creams and so on, these things are not available. And the other thing is, in some children, particularly immunocompromised children, impetigo can then become cellulitis and again can become a threat to life.
We've read and heard about the thousands and thousands of women who've been advancing through pregnancy and given birth since October 7th in the 9 months of this conflict. How about birthing-related infections, childbirth-related infections, and perinatal infections?
This, again, is a very big concern. And remember, this is also in women who are now starving. Many of them cannot breastfeed and again, are immunocompromised because of starvation. Now, we simply are not seeing, this is invisible right now, because women, if they get to the hospital, only get to have the baby there and they're out very quickly. Again, they're not getting the full long-term care. In some cases, their healthcare workers tell us it's very difficult to get people to leave the hospital. So some hospitals are actually full of people who are saying, I cannot leave the hospital because I've got nowhere else to go. And that means people coming in don't have a place. They're often giving birth on the ground in the emergency or in the corridors or in the emergency reception areas, or they may well be giving birth in the tents, in the informal refugee areas. So again, understanding what the level of pathology, what the level of harm that's been done to both mother and baby is something we really won't have any kind of measure of until the end of this conflict.
I mean, I'm running through all these various forms of infectious disease, and again, you're saying we simply don't know because we don't have the specialists there. Israel's not allowing them in. It's an incredibly insecure situation. But I wanted to ask you about like wound infections. There's like 90,000 people with injuries. And a couple of years ago, I was speaking with a couple of folks about antibiotic resistant infections in Gaza, particularly following the March of Great Return, and all these people who were injured, received gunshot wounds, leg injuries, and were coming down with, they were getting legs amputated, limbs amputated, and they were coming down with antibiotic-resistant infections. Some of them colistin-resistant, which is like the antibiotic of last resort for listeners who aren't aware of this. You know, it's terrifying. Is there any intelligence that WHO is receiving about the incidence of antibiotic resistant infections? And of course, there's the whole question about the availability of antibiotics.
We have seen some reports from Israel, some media reports, reports from Israel of returned soldiers who have been found to have antibiotic resistant infections. So that certainly, again, is a concern. I should say it's not necessarily that Israel doesn't let specialists in. We do have emergency medical teams and they do have specialists with them. Most of them are trauma specialists. The problem is for infectious diseases, you need to do laboratory testing. And the capacity to do the kind of laboratory testing that we'd want to do for really full surveillance just isn't there now at the moment because the laboratories we'd use have been destroyed and getting the samples back to other countries, we would take the samples back to Egypt for testing. That really hasn't been possibility or it hasn't been logistically viable. So it's not really that there's been a block on providing that. It's simply that the chaos and the difficulty of entry and the lack of unimpeded access. And also sort of for our teams, the main job at the moment is simply trying to get as many medical supplies to the few hospitals and public health centres that are functioning and also bringing people in. So we bring specialists in from other countries. It's extraordinary what goodwill there is out in the world. You know, we've got people lining up to come and help. So a lot of our work has been really to simply supply medical supplies, but supply people and medicine and the other kind of supplies they need. But the other work we normally would do, which would be very much our bread and butter work, managing surveillance, ensuring that we're tracking all the different infectious diseases, that's been a lot more difficult to do.
So how are people right now in Gaza being treated when they come down with infections? The incidence rates and prevalence of all these various infectious diseases is huge, like 1 million people suffering from respiratory infections, and who knows how many suffering from GI infections, diarrhea. How are these being treated?
I think that the awful truth is many of them are not, because indeed the primary healthcare centres that are recording the numbers that I'm quoting do their best if they have the supplies. But even they, you know, I was speaking with one doctor who has had to move 3 or 4 times. And every time she moves, she packs up the clinic and tries to carry everything with her. But each time she has to move, and then she has to find a new place to set up the primary healthcare clinic wherever she's been moved to. You know, if she finds an empty room in a school or something, she'll set up a primary healthcare clinic there. But each time she says she loses equipment, she loses supplies because she can only carry what she can carry. So they do what they can. And again, that's one of why we put as our top priority to get supplies to the clinics and hospitals so that when people present, ideally there is some kind of treatment. But the difficulty is A, getting to the clinic, B, having a clinic there, C, having the equipment and supplies there, D, having increasingly an expert person there, because many of the healthcare workers have been killed. We're losing hundreds of healthcare workers, or they may have not been able to get to the clinic or the hospital because they're having to look after family members, or they're displaced, or it's just impossible to get from wherever they are to the hospital. So the chaos and the constant danger of a simpler thing as going to work impedes the normal care you would normally provide for people. So again, that's why I'm saying that we are collecting these numbers. But and again, when we look at mortality rates and morbidity rates and injury rates, the numbers that are currently being quoted, I would say, are very much an underestimate.
Does the WHO have estimates of how many deaths will be associated with infection over the next 6 months or year? Like at this moment, some approaching 40,000 dead in Gaza, perhaps another 10,000 buried under the rubble, 80,000, 90,000 injured without access to health care. How many people deaths will be associated?
We have not. And one of the reasons not, again, as I said, to make it such an estimate, you have to have at least some clarity on what you're basing it on. And if you're not able to even do a household survey, to, you know, you could use in this as such circumstances where you can't actually count the body, it's an awful thing, but count the dead people or count the number of doctor's visits as you might do normally epidemiologically. You would go from clinic to clinic and look and count the numbers of people who presented with X, Y, or Z. But in a circumstance like this, you would really have to do what you'd call a household survey, where you would go to each household, and by households, I mean people living in tents or people who are a family group, and ask them who has died in your family, who has been sick, who has what has happened, and you would base your information on that. But currently, because it is so difficult to access anything, because we have no safe or unimpeded access to any part of Gaza, that sort of work is, it's not impossible to do, because we are definitely doing nutritional surveys, for instance, but we don't have the sort of baseline or that sort of data on which to make an estimate. So I can't really give you a number beyond what is being reported by the Ministry of Health that you have quoted. And we are confident that those numbers are, as I said, they are reliable numbers. They're based on what they are seeing in the hospitals, but what is happening outside of the hospitals is something that we really do not have a figure on.
But clearly, you know, 40,000 dead now, there are going to be many more perishing as the result of infectious disease, and over the long term, many more debilitated, stunted children as the result of malnutrition over decades and generations to come.
You're absolutely right. And this is one of the things that seems to be unrecognized. I'm very glad you've raised it. It's like you're putting a time bomb in a population. You are limiting the chances of these children to reach their full potential, but you're also making a likelihood, as you said, creating a level of disability that's going to condemn somebody who had the possibility of what we would call a normal life to a life of pain and struggle. And you're making it so much more difficult for a population. You are so limiting the future and so harming the future. I also think that I also know that the level of harm that's being done to mental health of the children, but also the adults, is something that's going to take generations, it's going to take decades to resolve, if at all. People must have such terrible unresolved grief. They don't know what happened to the people they love, or they saw horrific things happen to the people they love and could do nothing about it. And there are really no services or very limited services available to help people survive that. Added to that, they're in terror every day. They have horrific uncertainty. As I'm sure you know, uncertainty is the greatest mental stress of all. It's the hardest thing for people to deal with or recover from. And they are in conditions where they can't sleep. So when you are already suffering, either physically or mentally, you need sleep. Your body needs sleep to repair and try to recover. But they are being denied sleep because they're in such horrific living conditions. And you mentioned the rashes. You know, people are itchy all night. They're crowded. It's noisy. And it's terrifying. They never know when death's going to rain down from the skies.
We haven't spoken specifically about Almawazi, where like a million folks from Rafah have been crowded into, and the Israelis say, the conditions are okay there, if not just fine. What are conditions in Almawazi? Are WHO staff present in Almawazi?
Our staff moved to those areas. I'm trying to think. I think they're in Dera Bala, actually. But their conditions are not good anywhere. There is nowhere where you could say people are living comfortably and normally. So there is not a single place in Gaza that's safe or where people can live an appropriate, healthy life.
What's the situation like for WHO officials? How many staff does the WHO have in Gaza at this moment, roughly speaking? How many? And how many WHO has, I'm thinking it's WHO staff have suffered casualties themselves?
We have. And we did move most of our local staff at their request. They asked to be moved out into Egypt. But we have kept a international staff. It's a small staff and the number varies. We do have some national staff as well. I haven't got a specific number because it varies, as I said, and I don't think I'm even allowed to disclose exactly how many staff we have for security reasons. But again, our staff move in and out. It was actually my turn. We all take turns from Geneva to go in as well. But after the Rafah incursion and the closure of the crossing, it's been much more difficult for people to go in, internationals included. The only place that people can cross into is now Kerem Shalom, and it's become very difficult for even that. Now it's required by the occupying power, the Israelis, that only people who are international are allowed to drive the car to the crossing. So our staff who should be delivering supplies and looking at health conditions and working with the hospitals are now often acting as drivers because of the security requirements. And indeed, we've lost staff members. We had a young 28-year-old woman who was a coordinator for the limb replacement team, a very important team, and it's going to be an increasingly important team now that we've, so many people have had to have amputations as a result of lack of medical services and also the traumatic sort of injuries, the explosive injuries they've suffered. She was killed along with 50 members of her family in a bombardment of her home one evening. All of the United Nations teams have lost people, and we've had our convoys fired upon, and we've lost people when our convoys have been fired upon. So, yeah, it is a very, very dangerous place to be working, but we are definitely staying and delivering.
Last question, Margaret Harris, and thank you so much for joining me. No one more courageous, aside from the people, ordinary people of Gaza, in this situation than journalists and healthcare workers, physicians, nurses, clinicians, healthcare workers. Do you have a message? If you could put out a message to healthcare professionals around the world who are listening to this.
You are absolutely right. The healthcare workers and journalists have put themselves in danger every day, never stop working. They're working 24/7. In the early weeks of this conflict, I was amazed that they were continuing. And that was back in September. I couldn't believe that they would continue to work so hard for so long, nonstop, to save lives. And they haven't stopped since. I mean, we are now in July. We're now 9-10 months in. Journalists likewise, they've gone everywhere to bring the truth of what is going on, to show what is really happening. My message, healthcare workers around the world, you know, your brothers and sisters, your colleagues are doing what we all signed up to do, but doing 200% more. Yes, we all signed up to save lives. We all know that you do not ever drive past a person who needs your help. But they are doing it at the expense of their own lives and their own health, but they continue to do it. So we all need, all of us health workers need to stand up and remind those in power that this can be stopped. This is a man-made catastrophe. This is a man-made health disaster, and it can be stopped if those in power finally understand that there is nothing to be gained by this except horror, loss of health, loss of life, and it can be stopped. So we need to do everything we can to reach those who can stop it and demand that they do stop it.
Margaret Harris, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you so much, David.
Margaret Harris is a physician, an epidemiologist, and a former journalist and global spokesperson for the World Health Organization. Listen to our complete conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
Eravamo ancor fanciulli ogni sera su quel prato.